Are y'all warm?
Yeah.
If you're not warm, don't say anything, but that do it. We're in the book of Exodus, as you know. I was looking back on our previous schedule, and if I remember right and looked correctly, we started this book in May sometime. And so here we are getting close to being halfway through. How many of you remember old TV show? It's a comedy, I think it was, called Father Knows Best. Anybody remember that? Okay. It was, I think, produced about the time I was being born. So I don't remember it. But I was told they did a lot of reruns, so a lot of people that weren't living then perhaps have seen a lot of the shows. This morning, my title of my message is kind of a takeoff of that, as you can see. It's not Father Knows Best, it's Father-in-Law Knows Best. We're going to do a little poll here to start with. How many father-in-laws are in this room? Everybody raise your hand if you're a father-in-law. Okay, looks like about 10 of us perhaps. Okay. How many in this room has or have had a father-in-law? All right, lots more folks. Okay. Getting to people about 20 years old and up, male and female there with that question. One more question. Who has a father-in-law that is here today? Raise your hand. One, two, three. Three people with father-in-laws present. And one of them happens to be my daughter-in-law, Daniel's wife. And I'd like to ask a favor of her, if I could, just on the spot. We haven't rehearsed this or anything. But Kristen, could you read with a loud, clear voice, read the title of our sermon this morning? If it takes that, it'll be fine.
Father-in-law knows best.
Boy. Don't you like it when people put feeling into something? Father-in-law knows best. Give you a little history as a background for our text this morning. This morning we're going to look at the entire chapter 18 of the book of Exodus. But a little history. You'll see this on your outline. You remember Moses was about to be killed by Pharaoh because he killed an Egyptian and he fled for his life. He flees to a place called Midian. Now, in the providence of God, the place where Moses flees is close, the way if I understand this correctly, is close to the route where the children of Israel will be going across the wilderness. Okay, it's not right at it, I don't suppose, but it's in that area. That's where Moses goes, to the land of Midian. You remember he meets seven daughters of this man that's called Reuel and also called Jethro in the scripture. Reuel is perhaps, is the way I understand it, is his name. Jethro, which seems to me to be about the most unbiblical name you can think of, Jethro, you know. I guess the Beverly Hillbillies ruined that for me. But Jethro is more like a title that means His Excellency, which again doesn't go with the word Jethro in my thinking. But anyway, this guy has seven daughters, and they come to this well to draw water every day and or whenever they come. And just so happens Moses is there one day. And they always have trouble with these shepherds who push them out of the way and get their business took care of first and then leave the girls to fend for themselves. This particular day, Moses puts a stop to that. And we don't know how he does it, but somehow Moses lets them get to where they go first. So they get home early. And their dad says, well, why are you home so early? They said, because they tell the story. He said, where is this guy? You know, why don't you invite him home and eat with us? So it ends up, Moses ends up at their house. So he makes a good impression to start with. It goes on, the story goes on, and Moses eventually marries one of this man's daughters named Zipporah. They have a son, we can see from Exodus chapter 2, named Gershom. And the word Gershom means I was a stranger in a foreign land. Moses spends 40 years there. Now, in my own mind, you ever get something in your mind that's wrong and you just cannot change the course of your mind, your thinking to get on a new track? I'm that way with this story. You know, I grew up in church, hold this story, you know, ever since I was little, some of these kids here. And somehow in my mind, I've got Moses going to the wilderness, and he's there 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a year, and he leaves with a wife and 2 kids and the burning bush and the whole bit. And it never dawned on me that all that stuff couldn't be crammed into the 2 or 3 weeks I was allowing him to be there, you know. And at some point I found out it was 40 years, but I just can't follow that track of thinking. But he's there 40 years. Some of that time he spends tending to Jethro's sheep, and we know at that point he meets God at the burning bush. And he goes to talk to Jethro, and he tells Jethro his plans. What he'd like to do is go back to Egypt and carry his wife and, by that time, 2 sons with him. And on the way, a strange thing happens. At least seems like it's out of the ordinary. It seems like it doesn't fit. God has told him to go back and told him all that would happen. And let me read that God met him and sought to kill him. And the story just tells you 2 or 3 verses, and that's about it. It tells him the issue is over. Moses had failed to circumcise at least one of his sons. It says son, so perhaps he had circumcised one but not the other. And there's a confrontation there between Moses and God and between Moses and his wife, Zipporah. Now, I don't know what is going on there, but I kind of suspect, and this is just my supposition, so just something for you to think about. I think perhaps that God was getting Moses' attention. Perhaps Moses, and I'm going to use the term Christian life, but his spiritual walk with God, perhaps it had come to be a little casual, a little careless. And God was trying to get his attention because the task at hand, you can't afford to be careless. You can't afford to be easygoing and casual with your Christian life when God's leading you to go confront Pharaoh. Perhaps God is getting Moses' attention. I don't know. But that's all we read. That's all we know about Moses and his family until today, chapter 18. So, let's read the first 12 verses to begin with. Exodus chapter 18. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, with her 2 sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, for he said, I've been a stranger in a foreign land. And the name of the other was Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. Now he said to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her 2 sons with her. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him. They asked each other about their well-being, and they went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. Let's stop there for a little bit. So we see kind of the continuation of the story. We see that Moses apparently had sent his wife and two sons back home, back to his father-in-law's house, back to Jethro's house. When he did that and why he did that, we're not told. Okay? Perhaps it was over the spat he had with his wife about the circumcision. I don't really think that's the case. I doubt if that's it. If it was the year 2019, yeah, maybe. But I doubt if that was it. All right? A second option is that Moses realized at some point that there is danger, that this is a dangerous situation, and he's trying to get his wife and kids out of the way. Well, what about everybody else's wife and kids? Okay? I don't know. But it may have been that he wondered if Pharaoh, to put pressure upon Moses, may have taken advantage of his wife and kids and either kidnapped them or killed them or threatened them or whatever, so he's getting them out of the way. I can see that perhaps being the case. Another suggestion is that after they had crossed the Red Sea and they were traveling at the rate that they could travel, Moses sent a party ahead of them that included his wife and sons that could travel faster and went on to Jethro's place ahead of them and to let Jethro know how things are going and just to visit with her father or whatever the case may be. That may have been the case. I don't know. We don't know. But we do know the text says there in verse 2 that Moses had sent her back. And now they are traveling and they're in the vicinity of where Jethro lives, where Moses perhaps has seen this land before, and Jethro brings his wife and sons and they come to the camp and meet Moses. You see what we would expect of greeting someone you hadn't seen in a while. We see that now it names his second son that he's had, Eliezer. The name there, it says, means the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. I think that this is not the deliverance at the Red Sea. Because if this had been the deliverance at the Red Sea, this child would not have had, if he named his child at birth, he would not have had time to have been conceived and born in that time frame. It had to have been referring to the deliverance that God gave Moses from Pharaoh back when he fled from him at the burning bush and prior to that. All right, so, anyway, they're there. They visit. And then we see something about Jethro. Now, the question of whether or not Jethro is a true believer in God or not, it appears in some of the things that it says there about him, you might would think that he is. And maybe he is. I don't know. But at least he speaks favorably of God. At least he is impressed favorably with what God has done for Israel. And we see that Aaron, Moses' brother, and all the elders, and here we note that the Israelites have some people that they're calling elders, people in leadership capacity of some way. They had these even before they left Egypt. You see them there. Now, as we go through the text, it's a little hard to make a close comparison between applying these verses to our life with the way they're in the context of the Egyptians and the Israelites and in our context. So if you have issues with how I apply these, That's fine. I don't care if you have issues with it or not, you know. But I want us to just talk about some things and look at some things. Okay, the first one is this. This will be number three on your outline. Sometimes you can be too close to a problem to see it. Sometimes you can be too close to a problem to see it. Let's read verses 13 to 18. So Jethro's there. They've spent the night. And it says, and so it was on the next day that Moses set to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit, and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." So Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out, for this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself." So what's going on here? Jethro has been there how long? Overnight. Okay, overnight. It says the next day. He gets out and he sees Moses going about his daily affairs. Moses isn't taking the day off. Moses is doing what he normally does. And that involves, to some extent, hearing complaints from the people. And Jethro sees it, and the way it reads to me, Jethro makes a pretty quick analysis of what he sees. Jethro doesn't have to get a government grant and do a 3-year study on the effects of giving counsel to somebody. Okay, Moses doesn't have to have a certificate or a degree or any of those kinds of things. This is just what's happening. And Jethro comes to Moses. He's not beating around the bush about it, is he? He asks him, says, "What are you doing?" And I don't mean to inflect how he said it necessarily. But notice he doesn't, I use the word "what," the text uses the word "what," but the second question is really the question, why? I see what you're doing. Why are you doing this? And again, the question is not, why are you doing it? But there's another word that's really at the issue. Why are you doing this alone? And that's the issue in Jethro's mind. Why are you doing this alone? You will burn out. Now, I'm going to try to use the word traditional church experience without naming church types or church groups, but I may slip up, so that's okay. You probably know anyway. But in the church tradition that I've been in all of my life, except for this church, I have heard this figure 10 years ago, and I doubt if it's any different today. The average time span of a pastor at a church is 3 to 4 years. And then they are gone for various reasons. But in some way, I think it would, if we really knew the facts, somewhere in there's this issue of burnout. They are weary. And it's not just their fault. It's the system that is set up that they minister in that is conducive to that kind of environment. Most of my life, here's what I have seen. I've seen a pastor who is expected to preach 3 times a week. I've seen a pastor who is expected to be cool to teenagers. He's expected to have candy for the babies. He's expected to play bridge with the little old widow ladies. Okay? He's expected to visit anybody when they go to the hospital. He's expected to make the bulletins. He's expected to be at every function that the church has, every wedding, every funeral, and he's expected to keep his hands off the offering plate. Is that right? Pretty much. Pretty much, that's the way it goes. And pretty soon, all of his sermons pretty much start sounding alike because he doesn't have the time to put into in-depth study. It doesn't matter where his text comes from, he pretty much ends up saying a lot of the same stuff. And pretty soon, the lazy people that are out in the congregation who are expecting him to do all the work, why? Because we're paying him. Pretty soon, they make more demands and more demands, and as they see the quality of his ministry decreasing, they have more complaints because nobody has anything invested in this church except him. And he is burnt out. I haven't been there, but I've seen it. Years ago, probably 18 years ago, I don't know why I remember this. There was a pastor of church, similar to what I'm telling you, visit our church. And he was in the area visiting his family, and he just always wanted to come to church like this, so he showed up here. He came to church. He was here that one time and was gone. Two or three weeks ago, I met him again, at an event, and I didn't remember him. He remembered me because of other people that perhaps were around, but he asked me, he said, "You know, aren't you at Foothills?" And I said, "Yeah." And he asked me a little bit kind of about the way we did things. And he said, Don't you preach there?" I said, "Yeah, I preach every other week." And the look on his face said this: "Man, it must be nice. It must be nice to," and I thought this was what he was thinking inside. "Must be nice to share the load with somebody. It must be nice not to just be overwhelmed with stuff." You don't know how many times me or John or some of you perhaps will get a puzzled look on our face when they find out we're a church that has about 50 people and have two pastors, right? And you know the unspoken question is, what do you do? You know, what's the other guy doing? You know? Sometimes you can be too close to the problem to see it. Sometimes you can do things the same way for so long without even thinking about what you're doing, that you don't see what you're doing. Now, that's totally different than what Moses is dealing with here with Jethro, isn't it? But the principle, I think, is the same. A system, a thing that is set up in such a way that is harmful to you. You may be accomplishing good things, but it hurts in some ways. Number four, the benefits must outweigh the risk in order for you to be willing to take ownership or to share ownership of a ministry. Now, let me read that again and you think about it. The benefits must outweigh the risk in order for you, and that you there would be a ministry leader or the church leadership, in order for you to be willing to share the ownership of a ministry. Let's look at verses 19 to 23. Jethro tells this to Moses. Listen to my voice. I will give you counsel and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people so that you may bring the difficulties to God. You will teach them the statutes and the laws and show them the way in which they must walk with the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And then let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. Now notice the last two or three words here. So it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you. And if you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace. Okay? Jethro gives him a solution. Suggest to him a solution. Divide the people up, and it's not these figures of 50 and 100 and 510. I don't think that Jethro meant for these to be hard numbers. But just divide the people into smaller groups and place this person over this person over that, so there's a useful hierarchy, it's probably the wrong word, but hierarchy of authority that trickles down. And these people will be able to bear the burden with you. And things will go well and the people will be satisfied. They will go to their place in peace, he says. Now, I don't know what Moses thought when Jethro told him that. Jethro suggested finding good men, godly men, sound men, wise men, spiritual men. But if I had been Moses, I would have immediately been thinking, would that be Mike Bertolotte? Would that be John McCarty? Would that be Robbie Brock? Thinking through candidates, thinking through people who might fill that bill for me. And for me, and I suspect Moses as well, to be able to follow through with this counsel and with this advice, he has to be convinced that the benefits of doing it outweigh the risk that he takes in letting things go. What are the risks? Gets the wrong guy. Would be the first thing that come to my mind. Get somebody that's more trouble, causes you more trouble than just doing it yourself. All right? That would be a risk. It's the same risk that's taken in the church. But I'll just to tell you something. I hope you can, if you're not convinced of this, I hope you'll think about it and may God convince you of it, unless I'm wrong, obviously. But every church needs people who will take ownership of that church. Needs people who will own that church. Not the pastor. Every home needs parents and especially fathers who will own that home. You might have noticed our church is not very big. I don't know particularly the reasons for that, but I'll tell you one thing that I think sometimes is a factor. It's because we have, the elders have a philosophy that we are not going to parent your kids. We're not going to do it. We're going to encourage you to take ownership of your family. You don't see on our agenda, on our website, or anywhere else, anything about youth groups. Now, youth groups are not a sin. It's just that the youth in them usually do a lot of it. Okay? You don't see a lot of that here. Like, you don't see it at all. You don't see any youth groups. Because we understand and believe, are convinced, that a child who is 10 or 11 years old can be sitting there right now, like these kids are, like those kids are, and listen to what's being said. They can understand what I'm saying. I was reminded of this, I don't know how long ago it was, a year ago, 2 years ago. I was preaching, and in the course of the message, I asked a question. And it wasn't just a simple question like, who was Adam's wife? You know, it wasn't that simple. It was one that required a little bit of processing in your mind to answer the question. And I asked the question and asked like I do sometimes, ask you to answer it. And there was an 8-year-old girl. I'm not sure if she was 8. It was one of Robbie and Kim's girls. Sitting right there where Lori Grubbs is sitting. Sitting right on the end. I asked the question. Some of you answered. She answered. I couldn't exactly hear what she said, but I knew. I could read her lips enough, I knew she had the right answer. If I could have thought fast enough, I would have let her answer it aloud for us. How did that happen? I don't know. Exactly. I can tell you this much. I knew that girl had been taught how to listen, how to be still in church, how to listen to the minister. She had been taught enough that she could process not so simple information. I knew all that came because two parents owned their family. You've noticed we occasionally use some teenage, I want to call them boys, to take up the offering. Have you noticed that? You notice occasionally some of them will pray for the offering. How often do you see a 16-year-old boy praying publicly in church for the offering? Is it a canned prayer? No. You can tell that prayer had not been thought about before that moment. I didn't tell him I was going to ask him to pray for a blessing on the offering before church. It was right then they were suddenly confronted with it. 16 or 17 years old. You know what I was doing in church when I was 16 years old? I'm not going to tell you everything that I was doing. But most of it involved a back row with a bunch of other kids about that age, passing notes, eating candy, holding Susan's hand. Okay? Childish things. My kids are small. We taught them. We said the blessing at every meal, prayed at every meal. As they got, before they could talk really well, you know, we would encourage them, ask them, do you want to say the blessing? You know, and, you know, no, no, yes or no, whatever, you know. And, you know, starts out, if they say something that sounds like Jesus, that's cool. You know, that's enough, you know. And sooner or later, they, you know, start saying a little prayer. I did that when I was a kid. Here is our prayer that my parents taught us when we were little kids at mealtime. God is great. God is good. Let us thank him for our food. Amen. Isn't that a neat little prayer for a three-year-old? You know, my family prayed at meals all of my life. Occasionally when I would pray, that's my prayer. That's okay for a three-year-old. You know how long I prayed that little prayer? I'm not telling you. When it was old enough, I was looking in the mirror admiring my peach fuzz. Okay? That's sad. That's sad. Man who wasn't taught to think. 5 years ago, I've told this story in a sermon. I forgot what the context was. But Stephen Beavers is here. He'll remember this. Some of you probably will. I forgot what I was talking about. But I was talking about giving an example of his son, Spencer. His work ethic. Steve and them were doing some glass work for me on some trophy cases I built for the Hebrew school. They're installing them. It's the first time I'd ever been around Spencer on the job. He was, I think he was 13. But it was obvious that this kid knew how to work. Okay? They didn't have to, and I wasn't just making it a point to watch, but it is. It's hard not to notice. They didn't have to tell him what tools to get out of the truck. They didn't have to tell him to get them out of the truck. We're at the job. We're unloading our stuff. We're going up through here, and this 13-year-old kid is doing just as much as Zach was or as Stephen was. He knew what to do and was doing it. And I admired that. And it spoke not just of Spencer's character, but it spoke of something, some training that had been going on in his home from his parents. Now, I'll tell you something funny that I didn't tell that day. That went real well until the seventh grade girls came out to practice basketball. And then Spencer was, here's Zach. Here's Zach. I maybe exaggerate a little bit, but not much. Okay? Spencer is, how old is Spencer? 18? 18 years old. 2 or 3 weeks ago, he got engaged to be married. Is 18 too young to be married? No. Depends, doesn't it? It depends. My wife was 18. I was 21 going on 15. Okay? Thought I was 45. Okay? If Spencer and Madison hearts are given to God and their lives are committed to him forever, 18 is not too young. If their approach to their Christian life is one of carelessness, recklessness, casualness, there is never an age that's right. They will never be old enough. Years ago in 1976 or 77, I was a senior in high school or a year out, In a Sunday school class, I remember these figures. For people who go to church or in church all the time, the rate of divorce is exactly the same as the world. About 1 out of 2 marriages end up in divorce. But they said the families, the husband and wife, who go not just go to church together, but pray together, study together. In other words, their lives are owned by their faith. They own their marriage before God. The rate of divorce was 1 out of 1,016. Ownership. We want to provide you with an environment and encouragement in this place to own your home, to own this church. Jethro tells Moses, the result of this kind of thing will be that you will bear one another's burdens. I'll tell you what I like about this church. One thing I like about it. There are times when there are people here who are hurting. And it's not me primarily. I mean, most of the time, it's not me primarily who bears their burden with them. It is one of you. It's someone else. I like it, not because I'm lazy. I like it when someone asks about a ministry of the church and I don't have a clue what's happening there. And I'm a pastor. Because someone else owns that ministry. They don't have to get every move they made okayed by me or John. It is theirs, and they own it. Obviously, there's oversight to some extent. Let's move on. Number 5. You need to listen on this. It is not altogether common for the counsel of a father-in-law to be heeded. Some of you are chuckling. Some of you who are father-in-laws and mother-in-laws chuckle at that because you perhaps have experienced counsel that has not been listened to that you have given. It doesn't have to be a father-in-law or mother-in-law, it can just be anybody. Why is it that our counsel or your counsel is not listened to? Well, the first thing that we can get out of the way in a hurry is perhaps your counsel is just foolishness. Okay? And if your counsel is foolish, then I'm not going to plan on listening to it if I think it's foolish. And you ought not listen to mine. Okay? Perhaps that's the case. But I think more often than not, there's something else at play. A lot of it may stem, this may be one of those root sins we talked about on Tuesday night, in pride. We don't want people telling us what to do, especially our parents. Sometimes pastors are control freaks. And this is a dangerous place to be. For the life of me, I've watched documentaries there occasionally of some church or religious group that had, you know, like Jim Jones, for instance. How in the world anybody could ever get to the point where they swallow what this guy is telling them to do, I'll never know. I cannot fathom how you can go there, get that far into something. I know a guy, I carried his house a few miles down the road, that years ago when they first moved up here, they came here from southeast Arkansas where I was raised. He went to church down there. I don't know what church it was, but the church was governed by a pastor, one pastor, and he told you what to do. Before you could go buy a new truck, you had to get his approval. Before you could buy a house, he had to sign off on it, be okay with it. That's not for me. and it ought not to be for you. Okay? That is a dangerous place to be. It is uncanny how often those kinds of ministries and churches end up with the pastor telling the women of the church, you know what? That happens so often that they take advantage of people who are just stupid, okay? Horribly deceived. Sometimes leaders, pastors, feel threatened by their peers. Okay? I've seen this. Sometimes pastors don't want the people in their church very gung-ho about another pastor. Or I listen to MacArthur, or I listen to, you know, whoever, Chuck Swindoll, whoever is hot at the moment, you know. They don't like you. They feel threatened by that because they somehow want you to be dependent upon them. Now, that's not quite as in your face as these control freaks, but sometimes that happens. I've been in churches that was that way. I'm going to give you a statement here. You can see it on your outline. A pastor's goal should be to not be needed. Now, just chew on that for about a week, all right? Okay? If I'm doing what I want to do, to accomplishing what I want to accomplish, it's not that I'm going to sit around and do nothing. No. It's that you come to a place where you can get along without me. Now, that sounds arrogant, I know, but that's not, I don't mean it that way. It's where if I wake up dead some morning, you're going to go on, right? You're not going to have to search for what do we do now, because you own this place, not me. You own it. Life goes on. If we find ourselves in the place where we cannot meet in buildings, let's move to mainland China, why don't we? Okay, I'm hiding for sure if we do. All right? There's going to be some people have to own this thing. That's what I'm talking about here. I like to see a place where I'm not put on a pedestal, where John is not put on a pedestal. I don't want you, and some of you may do this, I can't think of anybody. I don't want you to call me Brother John. I certainly don't want you to call me Reverend Waldrop. Okay? I don't really want you to call me Pastor. I'm just John. I'm just another guy in the church. I want us to be, maybe I should just speak for myself, I want my life to be transparent enough that you see me. I don't have to hide myself. That you see me as I am. Maybe hide myself a little bit. But see me as I am, but yet trust in me enough that you listen anyway. Some guy that I know, I can't remember who it was now, but years ago, had been to seminary, and he told me that in seminary, and where he was at least, one thing that they were taught was not to develop close friendships with people in your church. That's not for me. I don't. In fact, that is harmful for me. I don't want to be somebody that has to go down the street to another pastor at another church to have a friend. I want friends. friends here. I need friends here. You know who my closest friends are in this church? If you were to think, you probably would know. Some of them are Brian McDaniel, Christy McDaniel, Craig Grubbs. All right? Why is that? It's because on Sunday mornings at 9 o'clock, we are here. And we plan to practice. But what we do after 20 years of being here at 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings is we share life together. We share life together. That's what I need. That's what you need. You need that too. Are you listening? Yep. Jethro told Moses, listen to me. If you will do this, there will be peace in the camp. Does it seem strange to you that Moses would listen to Jethro? Do you know who Moses was? Moses was the guy that had the big stick. Right? Moses could take that stick and strike a rock and water comes pouring out of it. Enough water to feed 2 million people, to give drink to 2 million people. Moses was the guy that had the stick that held it up and the waters departed. And the people walked through on dry ground. You know, it don't take much of that kind of stuff to give a guy a big head. Does it? Most pastors would come to think, I'm really somebody. And here comes this clown telling me, here's what you ought to do. There's not many folks that would listen to that. Would you? Would I? Gosh, I hope so. Let me give you a chapter to read. And then we're going to close here in a second. Numbers chapter 12. When I was thinking of this text, I was thinking of what it took in Moses for him to listen to his father-in-law, for him to heed to his voice, it said, and do all that he said. What kind of does it take in a guy's character for him to do that? It takes humility. What does the Bible say about Moses? Says he was the meekest man among all of the men on the earth. You know where it says that? I didn't know. I had to look it up. It says it in Numbers chapter 12. You ought to read that chapter. My. Let me give you a summary of it. Moses' brother and sister, Miriam and Aaron, have got a bee in their bonnet about Moses. And they come to think that Moses is just, thinks he's a little too good, you know, and starting to complain against Moses and all this stuff. And I may have my details not exactly right, so forgive me if you go and read it and find it differently. But they're griping against Moses. And God comes along, and God says, we're fixed to have a little powwow. Okay, some people call that a come to Jesus meeting. Okay, we're fixed to talk. And God, I think it says he tells where all the people, the Israelites, all of them heard this. God tells them, says, listen, when I have a prophet, he may see visions. And I may give him a message to you through a prophet who sees visions and hears me in voice. But this guy, this man, Moses, I talk to face to face. You're messing with my man. I can't remember what all happened, something about a cloud, but next thing you know, what happens? Miriam has leprosy. God strikes Miriam with leprosy. I'm sure everyone ran like scared rabbits. Miriam is horrified. Aaron is horrified. God is gone. Aaron says to Moses, speak to God that he will touch her and take the leprosy away, heal her. You know what most people would have said at that point? Let her suffer for a little while, the wretched hag. Right? Moses cries out to God. Moses doesn't do that. Moses cries out to God and says, oh God, touch her body. The Bible says he was the meekest man on the earth. What are you? What are you like? One last point. This is the last verse, 27. Then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way to his own land. This point is not for you. It's for Kristen. Strictly for her. And here's the point on the outline. Rejoice that, at least for now, your father-in-law is able to still live in his own house. All right? I got to keep on her good side. Okay? That's it. We're going to keep going in chapter 19. Chapter 20, we start the Ten Commandments. So, one was a family history, two, a family reunion. Okay? Let's pray. God, thank you for your word. God, thank you for, Lord, just giving us each other. God, I thank you for these people who have challenged me about paths that I wanted to go down and should have had enough sense not to. God, I thank you for parents, a dad, and a mom. God, especially my dad, who showed me how to walk. God, would you burn into our souls the importance and the eternal value of owning our home, of owning this place. God, bring glory to your name. Amen.